Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, to keep up on our most recent podcasts. We've recently discussed the movie Annihilation, The Shape of Water, Seconds from the 60s, Point Blank and The Limey in one podcast, and then our most recent episode was on The Lost City of Zed. I also wrote something recently that was about young adult.
Pots and Pans.
Also Pots and Pans. yeah, about young adult and Diablo Cody in general, because I'm very excited for Tully. Anyway, themacguffinmen.com, and you can check that out.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
We have made it through the theme song.
We have.
And we're here to talk about Rosemary's Baby.
Yes, we are. 1968, a well-known movie, National Film Registry, Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. Sort of responsible, or one of the movies responsible for elevating horror into a respectable movie. I mean, this got some awards nominations, obviously. Hitchcock had been working before this time, so it wasn't like it was all, B-movie film you can write off, but this helped kind of push it up into a bit more respectable areas, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it also comes at, there's a time period situation that really helps it out in that it just happens to be at the beginning of, I mean, we've talked about this, or specifically I have mentioned this a million times, 1967 is the year that Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate come out. The editor for The Graduate actually got asked to work on Rosemary's Baby, but he was too busy working on The Graduate. So he suggested his assistant editor, who then went on to become a very notable editor. There's just both a lot of talent going around at the time and a lot of people willing to take chances. Robert Evans, this is one of his big movies. He just started working at Paramount at this time. And he would famously go on to help shepherd The Godfather, and is just in general a very legendary Hollywood character. But yeah, it's sort of, I mean, like any great movie, circumstance plays a big part in it. And this movie was made at a time when people were starting to be willing to take some chances with choosing directors, willing to take chances with genres as well. And Rosemary's Baby is, I think, a good example of that,
Yeah, and like a lot of stuff around this time period, based on a novel by Ira Levin. And, I mean, just because you said Roman Polanski, this movie's going to be tricky to talk about in at least a couple ways that I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, so... I mean, I'm still like kind of amazed by how little I knew about this movie before watching it. I hadn't seen it until we chose it as, and also I chose it as a podcast topic. I will 100% say that. But yeah, I did not know anything about this movie. I didn't know it took place in New York. I thought it took place in the, all I knew was the poster. I thought it took place in the country somewhere because that's generally assumed to be true of a horror movie. This is a movie that I don't want to use the word best, but like the most horrifying scene in this movie is a rape scene. And this movie is written and directed by an admitted rapist, And I wouldn't feel comfortable dancing around it for the whole podcast. I also wouldn't feel comfortable leaving it at the end as sort of an afterthought, because that's kind of what we did with our Chinatown podcast. And over the years, I've kind of had some regrets about that. But as you said, this is a movie that is in the Library of Congress. It's a notable movie in cinematic history. And if we knew the truth about so many of the movies from the 30s and 40s and 50s that we've talked about, where the truth would just never get out because all the parties have died and it was just a time when you don't talk about anything, we wouldn't talk about any classic cinema, probably, Yeah. So it's just really difficult. And we're also I can imagine a scenario 5 years from now where I regret choosing to do this podcast. I don't know. We're just so in flux right now. And the fact that this was named to the Library of Congress in 2014, decades after Roman Polanski admitted to rape. I don't know. It's tricky all around. And I just wanted to talk about it so we don't have to dance around it. And also, I just didn't want it to be an afterthought because, I mean, it's just a more important story than anything that can happen in a movie, you know, because it's real life.
Yeah, no, that's I think I can agree with everything that you said there. And 2014 seems so recent and so distant in the past at the same time, especially on this subject. And I think that one of the things that makes this tricky is that it's not a really easy movie to pin down. And I think a lot of the intentional discomfort of this movie is who you side with at any given moment, and just the amount of gray that's kind of you are forced through between edges of black and white while watching this movie. So I think that makes it tougher. Whereas this was, if the ideas that we think are supposed to be expressed in this movie were all things that you and I can now say we full-heartedly disagree with, then we could state that outright. And if we can say that, you know, we support all of this, that would be easy to state as well. But I think that this movie is intentionally tough to read and kind of forces you, as I said, in between two stances pretty quickly at different times. So I think it would have been tricky without Roman Polanski's very terrible personal history, but that's just another dimension that makes it, as you said, just impossible to not have to kind of deal with.
Yeah, that's true. Like, this, it doesn't matter who directed this movie. If it, the movie exists as it does, as the movie that we've watched, and it would be hard to talk about in 2018 in general, you know, which I think is what you're talking about a little bit. But yes, just the Polanski thing means we just have to mention it up front immediately.
Yes.
So we don't seem like assholes.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, smooth transition to talking about the movie.
Yeah, well, we can talk about something that you already mentioned, just the urban nature of this, which, as you stated, is something pretty unusual. And horror films, you know, you said sometimes you think of them in the country. You can get as urban as the suburbs. And there are definitely exceptions to that, but it is by far the minority in that aspect, right?
Yeah, and I also, I can't claim to be a horror aficionado in any way. So, like, it's usually, for me, it's like every couple of years I watch a horror movie that I get all excited about. You know, like Get Out was last year's horror movie that I got all excited about. And for budgetary reasons, that does not really take place in a city. Right. And I would imagine Hereditary will be this year's version of that, judging by the buzz it's gotten. But yeah, so I can't speak to the personally to the evolution of the genre, but I can regurgitate things that I've heard other people say about the genre. And what other people have said about the genre is that it was very uncommon for horror movies to take place in the city, and then this one did, you know? And I kind of like the element of it taking place in the city. One, because I think shooting in New York at this time period is just, like, that's just a look I will always be interested in. Something about the look of New York in the 60s and 70s. I think it mostly just reminds me of this period of movies. I think that's partially why I like like the look. Yeah, I just think it's an interesting looking city, and that combined with filmmaking techniques at the time, it's just, I don't know, it's a good look to me. And I also just like the idea of evil permeating the city, which I think, given like this specific movie, the idea that evil is everywhere, I think it's cool that it's not just limited to a suburb or anything like that, where it's like, here's this perfect looking place that now has evil in it. You know, if you got Michael Myers coming through your window or whatever, this is a city that you know, I'm speaking as somebody that lives in a city that you walk around all the time, and there's just, there could be evil looking at you at any point, you know? The sort of conspiracy elements of this movie just play a lot better because she's in a city surrounded by way more people that she can be afraid of at all times. Yeah.
And
it's basically Hutch that she's not afraid of, and Charles Grodin, but even he ends up being terrifying.
Yeah, we're finally satisfying all the Charles Grodin completists out there. No, I think that you're right, and I think that this isn't an original observation either, but there isn't a ton of supernatural scares in this movie. I mean, there's two gigantic ones, mm-hmm. but for the most part, it's this, kind of this feeling of paranoia from the people that you know and distrust from the people closest to you. And I think that that sense of loneliness and claustrophobia can work really well in an urban setting like this, like that she has people all around her. She sees her doctor regularly, but is still, you know, unhappy and afraid. And it's not a sense of isolation and the calls coming from inside the house, even though in an extremely true way that the call is coming from even closer than inside the house. But, you know, it's not this idea that the slasher is there and you need to, you know, run down the staircase and get past him. It's this pervasive feeling of the people all around you intending you harm when they're the people that you trust the most.
Exactly. Especially since it's like, this is a movie that sort of, pretty easily falls into tropes of nobody believes in me sort of movie. Nobody believes what I'm saying. You know, she's got, or nobody will listen to me, a combination of the two in this case, I suppose. You know, she's dealing with some pretty serious pain for so much of her pregnancy, and so many people around her are like, cool, you know, like that's normal. It'll pass in a couple of days, which is insane. Yeah, and just that type of thing, and that mixed with the just constantly Guy just apologizing to her and then immediately doing the thing he was apologizing for again. Just I think John Cassavetes is awesome in this movie. I think the way that he somehow navigates playing, I don't know, the way that he can apologize in a way that seems so sincere for exactly 3 seconds, I think that's really, that feels like something that would have to be really difficult to pull off when you're performing. And I think that's so integral to his character. The fact that he, I don't know, he doesn't really seem to change a lot, but there's just little things that he has to do to make you feel like you can understand why Rosemary would continue not hating him. And just the amount of times he has to do that throughout this movie for a very brief stretch of time before immediately jumping back into being obviously self-centered. I think that's a really, really difficult trick. And Mia Farrow gets the showier stuff to do in this movie, and she's fantastic in this movie. But I think he sort of gets, in the conversations about this movie, I feel like people sort of glaze over how difficult his performance is, you know?
Yeah, it's just a smaller role, and to have nuance and kind of such a narrow berth, I think, is what you're getting at.
Yeah, and just that all of his stuff, all of those performance elements that I mentioned augment the fact that, you know, nobody will listen to Rosemary, but she loves this person enough that she will take his word for that what she's doing isn't wrong, you know? It's just that this difficult, like, she knows that something's wrong, but since Guy doesn't necessarily agree with her, she starts to doubt herself because Guy is the person that she loves the most in the world, you know?
Yeah, and I think that that feeling of doubt and just the, this is so broad, but the subjective nature of existence at all, I think, is a big part of this movie. And I know that sounds very kind of spacey, but it comes up a lot. And I think it comes up through the way it's written. I think that the way that it's filmed, we get that. And what I mean by that is, you talk about, you know, her explaining her feelings, like, you know, her physical feelings of the pain that she's in and trying to communicate that. And emotionally, the way she clearly goes back and forth with her husband about how she feels about him. in that, you know, whether it's an emotional pain or physical pain, it's so personal that it's hard to communicate that. And, mm-hmm. You know, eventually she kind of gets to the point where she realized that this pain shouldn't continue for that long. And, you know, not by luck, it seems that her pain goes away right after she's about to make a big change. But I think that's a big part of that. And watching this movie is about experiencing this story through her subjective eye. I mean, we also get looking at her, but I think so much of this movie is told from her point of view. You know, there's not much of this movie that she's not in, tellingly. We get to see, you know, what she is looking at in perfect POV shots several times. And it feels like a very, it's weird to say this, but like a very realistic, natural movie, except for the scenes that so clearly aren't, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I was getting at when it says this movie kind of pushes you from sympathizing with her to sympathizing with the people around her who are acting in direct contradiction to her wishes. It just is a movie that really plays with subjectivity and doubt so much. And I think that's something that I really like about it, and something that makes it hard to pin down, or one of the things that makes it hard to pin down at all.
Yeah, I agree entirely. And just the number of times she's just having a conversation and you just, I don't know. It's so weird. Like the things in this movie that make you feel the most uncomfortable, with the exception of the rape sequence, which is the most viscerally uncomfortable thing to watch. I find it really impressive how the things that probably scared audiences, like I'm at a disadvantage because I'm watching it, you know, at home. And so there's only an amount of, like, there's a level that I can get sucked in, and I can't really top that. And it just doesn't match the theater. The idea of watching this in the movie theater in 1968 is really fascinating to me, because I would imagine people screamed for sure at that phone call scene late in the film when that guy just shows up in the background, which is just such a normal thing to happen. Like, somebody's just standing outside of a phone booth. And then also when the people... once she gets back into her apartment after the getting away from Saperstein and by spilling her purse in the lobby, and then she makes that phone call and people are like very like almost comically tiptoeing by in the background. That was probably like a scare in the movie, and just those like very like almost goofy looking things. The fact that they can seem kind of terrifying is kind of interesting, and there's just a lesser extent, or a lesser version of that, is the conversations with the doctors where Saperstein is explaining things and you're just like, I don't know, something feels wrong, but he's a doctor, you know? Yeah. We're supposed to trust this person because, one, he's a doctor, two, he's been recommended by people that she knows, but just it all feels wrong. And I think that those scenes where people are telling her things that you're like, okay, this is a person that I'm supposed to trust, but this doesn't sound right at all. I think this is something that Mr. Castevet says, Roman says, drugs in a pharmacy can lose their potency after shit sitting on the shelf for a number of months or whatever. I'm like, well, I could see how like Rosemary might listen to that, given that it's coming from somebody that she's decided to trust, but like, it just doesn't sound logical, you know? Those things exist all throughout this movie, especially in the first half. You know?
Oh yeah. No, I think that this movie owes so much of its emotional power to never really letting you get comfortable like that. Yeah. Yeah, it's just things that are so counterintuitive that get said to Rosemary, like, don't read books or ask your friends. Reading books and asking people who genuinely care about you are like two things I recommend to everybody in the world.
Yeah. Or we should point out, you are not a doctor, so you should listen to your advice, because you're not an evil satanic doctor.
No, that's right. But it's just, that seems like such good life advice, completely subverted, right? And then you see it from the other side, you know, at the same time, it's like telling someone, don't just Google your symptoms and think that's what you have, you know, don't just listen to what your friends have heard on Facebook. Like, I'm a doctor, you should listen to me. So, you know, it goes back and forth. And at times something is seems so obvious, and then you think about it, or sometimes something seems so obviously negative, and then you, or something so positive, and then you think about it a little bit more. And as I said, this isn't a movie that has your jump scare every 15 minutes to make sure that you're unsettled. It has, you know, maybe I'm forgetting one, but 2 to 3 obviously like viscerally unpleasant scenes, and then the rest is just kind of pushing the boundaries of your intuitions and asking you to take a stance on something that's pretty gray. And I think that it's just such a nuanced success in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. And it also sort of draws you into Rosemary's perspective, especially since I think the rape sequence happens at about the 50-minute mark of the movie. And so you just sort of, you're just watching Rosemary live her life, move into this new place with her husband, Guy. Something that the production designer, his name's Richard Silbert, said in an interview I was watching, said that the core of the movie, or the reason the movie works, is because it starts out like a Doris Day movie and then everything goes haywire. And I haven't seen Doris Day movies because I'm too young, but that would certainly be what I would imagine happens in a Doris Day movie. Somebody goes looking for a new apartment. And just that, you know, and then you sort of start to, you have all these sequences where people are having conversations, they meet the cast of vets, they're talking to them, you watch Ruth Gordon do some five-star food acting, and just all these things that are just like a normal part of living and moving into a new place, a montage where they're putting up wallpaper and all that, her watching her husband's ad on television, those things just sort of start to be reframed after you start to go along the journey with Rosemary of her starting to doubt all these things. You start thinking back about all of those things that happened before the rape sequence of the movie, which is really what the movie turns on. And you just sort of start to think like, why does Hutch know all this stuff about witchcraft and this building? Like, that seems a little weird. Why is he sitting next to a picture of Winston Churchill? Just even stuff like from the one person outside of Rosemary that we're supposed to trust in this movie, you sort of start to rethink the meaning of these things. And what you were saying about it just sort of being a nuanced movie, I think the reason it works so well is because it sort of lulls us into Rosemary's perspective without us realizing that when something visceral happens, one, it's horrifying because that sequence is like very difficult to watch. And two, it just sort of like you are just locked into Rosemary's perspective for the rest of the movie because of the way that the movie like gets you in her mind, basically, or in her as close to her perspective as you can.
Yeah, and the you know, you talk about it, this is like a Doris Day movie. Even after some unpleasant things happen, this kind of teeters back into like a comedy, dark comedy kind of feel. Like full scenes will go by that are just characterization, and you know, there's dynamic elements to these characters, but we're not getting super dark with them. You know, you're just kind of fleshing out these characters, which I think this movie does a great job of doing with several characters when some movies can't really do it with one. Mm-hmm. And the notion of space, I think, too, is at the beginning, the tour of the apartment, I think, is a great one where I think it's a great scene that does a lot of, like, quickly shows that this movie is going to do a lot of the things that we like about it, how it is playful and fun and dark and unnerving at the same time. And that very notion of that the apartment isn't fully theirs. You know, there are things that are blocked off. There are spaces that are too close to their neighbors where you can hear them through the walls and mm-hmm. things like that. That there is this section of geography that's, you know, partitioned off, but in a way it never really feels completely their own. And I hope this comparison doesn't come off as, you know, super insensitive and glib, but as we kind of learned, Rosemary's body is not going to be hers the whole time, or at least it's going to be treated like it's not really hers. Mm-hmm. Which I know that can sound really cold, but it's the way that this movie chooses to talk about her, right? She has her body. She makes a choice to make a baby. You know, she doesn't seem to be pressured into that. She seems very happy. But then this awful rape sequence that's part of her dream. We see, you know, the devil raping her. We find out that she was raped by her boyfriend when she wakes up the next morning, who is, you know, we'll say significantly less remorseful than he should be, and that he's not God. Remorseful at all.
It's the things he says are just crazy.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. And then it kind of gets, or at least he hopes to play it off like, you know, we wanted to make a baby together. I'm doing something that will help us do that, right? He has a bit of a, he has sort of his personal logic about why it was the right thing to do. And, you know, so that was this massive violation of her body and her space. But then she, you know, she does get pregnant from it. And then we see her, you know, the drinks that she's given and the advice kind of take over more and more of her body and more of the fetus that's inside of her. And then by the time that baby is ready to be born, even that is taken away from her. So even in that first scene, which I think is like fun, and you know you're in a horror movie when you start watching Rosemary's Baby in 2018, so your antennas are definitely up, but it's not so unpleasant at the beginning, and it's kind of funny. You know, he's looking for weed in the herb garden or whatever. And I just think that they're, you know, especially at the beginning, they seem like a nice, happy couple. You know, we've talked about him not being so good in some smaller things, and I just talked about a way that he's massively not very good in one of his actions in this movie, at least. But just the way that that apartment scene does so much for this movie and so much of what it plays out to be, and how it's sets up these very weak boundaries that get torn down in these awful ways by the end of the film is impressive.
Yeah, exactly. And I think something that's worth noting in that scene is the there are a couple moments. One is the secretary that's blocking that closet. That ends up being the closet that Rosemary uses to go into the Castevets, apartment in the end, and that they used to get into hers when she locks them out. So that's like a good moment of setup that doesn't pay off for almost full 2 hours, because this movie is about 2:15, and that happens probably in like minute three, and doesn't come back until very late.
But you still remember it with a couple of breadcrumbs that they drop throughout.
Exactly. Too. And also the performance that the guy showing the apartment is giving is just so, like, it's so weird that the characters in the movie have to comment on how bizarre he is. I forget what Alicia Cook Jr., there it is that performer's name. And there's just like everything he says, he like raises his voice at the end of every sentence, even though it's not a question. And his eyes are so wide open. It's just about, there's just an element of bizarreness to his performance that I think really carries throughout a lot of the performances in this movie, most notably Ruth Gordon, where it's just like nothing he is doing is bizarre, but the way that he does it is just so bizarre, you know? And that combined with when Rosemary sees that, the note in the lady's, it's actually next to her garden, I think, on piece of papers that she's written on, "I can no longer associate myself," is written on it. And, you know, that even that's just a really small, but good moment, for setting up what is to come. You know, it's like, I no longer know who I am, you know, and, I no longer know which way is up, and Rosemary is about to be in that position, you know? So I think like what you're saying about this being a movie that's set up really well, I agree with wholeheartedly.
Yeah, and we've talked about it, especially in action movies, but horror movies, it's important too, just setting up geography well in a way that it's not too clunky and expository, and having that pay off well later. This is kind of a masterclass in that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It helps you because it gets you more into the perspective of the character, and horror and action, those are movies that hinge on you being able to forget that you're watching a movie. So that would hinge on you like attaching yourself to a character in a situation, right? So you sort of become a part of the game when say a horror movie, somebody's being chased through a house. If you know the layout of that house from an earlier scene, you're like, okay, what if you go here, 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 and you're sort of like trying to think of what you would do if you were Sidney Prescott in Scream, you know, trying to get away from Ghostface. And yeah, that applies to action movies as well. It's just so important to helping you get into these more heightened scenes, and with Rosemary's Baby, that rule definitely applies. as well.
Yeah, and this isn't so much of a physical geography thing, but you know, what we're talking about who to believe and, you know, kind of feel like you losing your mind a little bit. When we see her friends trying to talk her into her old friends, her younger friends, trying to talk her into going back to see Dr. Hill. And there's this push and pull for a while while she's tried to argue for it. We feel that Saperstein is obviously not really going to be on our side, but we understand why she's going to him. You know, he's very famous and very highly recommended and very well known. And there's that carrot of Dr. Hill throughout this movie that, like, if she can assert herself, or if she can manage to get away from these awful people trying to prevent her from asserting herself, that if she gets to Dr. Hill, everything's going to be okay. And then we get that that moment where she does make that decision and she is able to stand by it and he sells her out. And I think that was just to have that object, you know, Dr. Hill, just this idea that if you can get to him, things are going to be okay, to have that notion out there for so long. And then she finally achieves it. And to have it come, you know, nothing positive come of it, I think is another great example of setting up expectations and then ripping out the floor from under you.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Because that's that one. I don't know. For some reason, that one's awful to me. But it's that scene where, if Dr. Hill is acting in his best interest, you kind of see where he's coming from, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, you could also buy the idea that maybe he's a part of the satanic cult. Like that's just everybody that comes through the movie in some way. You're like, I don't know, maybe they're in on it. Like even Charles Grodin, he might be in on it, but yeah, you can see that would be the way that he would see as the logical way to deal with that situation. If he doesn't distrust Saperstein in any way, then I think what he would do is just make sure that Rosemary feels safe and comfortable, and then he would call a person that would know her better. And from what she has told him, even though she is terrified of him, rightfully so, like you can sort of see why he would act that way, you know?
Yeah, and even if he's not, even if he's not,
yeah, exactly. Even if he's not satanic himself. Or Satanist himself.
Yeah, that's just a tough moment because, you know, once someone shows up at the doctor's office with witchcraft books, you kind of know which way that conversation is going to go.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Because we've seen the way she's been treated all this time, and unlike Hill, we've kind of seen her go from someone who is, you know, bubbly and, you know, under control and having, you know, seemingly enjoying her life and her relationship to, you know, kind of unrelenting emotional and physical abuse to turn into the person that shows up at Hill's doctor's office by the time she makes that decision to. It's so much different.
Yeah, yeah.
And you understand why she is acting the way that she is.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You mentioned the apartments and, or I suppose more specifically Rosemary's apartment. And one of the things I like a lot about the production design of this movie specifically is the way that they show the differences in the Castevet's apartment and Rosemary and Guy's apartment. Because everything in the Castevet's apartment, I mean, I just finished a book of Sherlock Holmes stories, and like, those all sound like they take place in rooms just like the Castevet's apartment, you know? And those are stories that are taking place in like the 1890s. But it's the 1960s, and it just sort of feels like they have like saved this corner of New York to remain untouched. Even though the carpet is new, literally everything else seems to be just there for decades. The way Ruth Gordon's makeup, it's like she's just over the top. Like she's wearing so much makeup as somebody that sort of lost touch with reality. The way that Roman sort of talks sometimes. Ask me, name a place I've been there, whatever. Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been there. You know, like all of these things, and in the way that their apartment is shown and the way that they're shown in it is just so old world. And then you look at Rosemary, and I mean, a notable moment in this movie, other than I went down and got this haircut from Vidal Sassoon, just being a funny line to me. But it, like, it's a mod haircut. Like, it's a very modernist approach hairstyle, and as is the way that she sets up the apartment, which we are shown to or would led to believe by the movie that she basically takes charge of everything as far as how the apartment is laid out. You know, because the table is placed in a certain way in the kitchen, and Minnie comments on it. Oh, that's an interesting place to put a table. Yeah, I saw it in a magazine, you know, and it's just Rosemary takes this sort of modernist approach to her hairstyle and her apartment. And it's just interesting how starkly the Castevets apartment can contrast that, despite the fact that they are like, you can literally hear them through the walls. That's how close they are.
Yeah, no, you touched on a lot of things there that I didn't want to talk about. I think that there's always this feeling with every generation about, you know, your parents' generation or the generation that came before you, imposing their ideas on the current generation or on your viewpoint. And I think we get that sense really strongly in this one. You know, maybe they're a little old, but you can get the sense that these people, the Castevets, are just the perfect age or a bit older to be Rosemary and Guy's parents, right? Mm-hmm. As you pointed out, they seem way older than that, and everything about the production design definitely communicates that. And just the amount of control they take over Rosemary and Guy, you know, they win Guy over pretty quickly, despite the idea he puts forth that he isn't going to want that. You know, what the drinks that they start giving Rosemary, and you know, they're feeding them food that may or may not / totally is drugged. And just the way they'll come over and snoop around her apartment, and just that her life is something to be kind of gone through and to be examined and to be made changed by someone else's tastes and morality, I think is a strong feeling that comes to this movie. And just one of those other things that Rosemary's life and body and mind are something that are not fully belonging to her. And, you know, we've kind of looked at that from a gender standpoint, but I think Minnie, Ruth Gordon's character, kind of brings an interesting counterpoint to that, that there is a generational element to this too. And we see that with the mod haircut. I mean, it's called a mod, you know, it's kind of on the nose about how modern it is. But I think that, as I said, that's true of all generations, but I think it's the 60s are one of those times that we think of that notion being particularly important, and that this generation is trying to get away from what their parents did and trying to shape a morality for themselves. And this movie, with all of its talk of religion and tradition and old cults, I think puts forth this idea that there is still these institutions and still these traditions that are being imposed on today's younger or just young adult generation.
Yeah, exactly. And even at the end, you can sort of see this as, I mean, there's a million ways to see that ending, but since we're talking about sort of the old versus new, you see Rosemary for about as long as possible, right before the movie ends. She kind of almost not necessarily crosses over, but just sort of takes a trip to the satanic side to go over and just rock her baby to sleep. That sort of, to me, implies that no matter how new and creative you try and be with the way to live your life, you will end up being corrupted by the old ways. And I think that's an incredibly dark ending to an already extremely dark movie. And just like the person that that goes through the worst of it in this movie unequivocally is somebody who never gives in to this old, the sort of older world, the satanic world of Guy, who we haven't even mentioned him, quote unquote, selling his soul to further his career, and how self-centered that is. And he gets out of the movie pretty much unscathed because he just sort of committed to the old horrible world early on, whereas Rosemary goes through all this stuff and ends up losing anyway. And it's just it's deeply sad. And yeah, it's a horror movie and it's horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing about Guy is that it's not as though he gets out scot-free, right? He has given over his child to this cult, but it is a decision that he makes, right? He's balanced these things and made a choice, and he benefits from it. And in a way, Rosemary will benefit from his wealth and fame, but
I mean, in theory, she's still with Guy, you know, like that's a
yeah.
I don't think that's necessarily good for her.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not trying to justify this. I'm just saying, like, it's a decision that he makes for both of them.
Exactly. He has agency. She does not in the
yeah,
decision.
Exactly. And I think that we haven't really talked a lot about her Catholicism. It was mentioned once, but I think mm-hmm. that just the amount of discussion and religious imagery that goes on in this film, we can't really understate how important that is. And this is the time when the Catholic Church is still against birth control. You know, we're not far off from Roe v. Wade. There's just all these things that speak to at this time of other people making decisions about women and their bodies. And that's what Guy does here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Did you give any significance to it's the baby's eyes that are sacrificed or lost?
No, I mean, my immediate answer is no. I didn't think about that at all. Do you have a take?
Just that it would be, yeah. I mean, we haven't really talked a lot about that trade off, which is a pretty central part of this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, a guy is struggling as an actor. He gets his success because an actor he was up against, or actually had already lost the role to, went blind, and then eventually it's when the baby is born that the baby has Satan's eyes or has his father's eyes. Just that idea that this baby is not going to be able to see anymore, he's not going to be able to take in the world as it is and is going to rely on other people to explain the world to him. And I think that ties in well with this idea that we were talking about of just taking what the old world has given you. Guy really aligns himself with the old world and the benefits that come from it. And when we talk about the 60s and that optimistic view of society, that this generation is going to be the one that thinks about the earth and thinks about the poor and thinks about other countries in a way that is going to bring more equality to the world. Well, if the other side of that is to just keep doing things as they've been doing and reap the benefits of it, and seeing a broken system and getting on the beneficial side of that instead of changing the system that's broken. And that's what I think Guy ultimately chooses to do, and ties in with the way he allies himself with the old world and all the witchcraft traditions.
Yeah, that is an interesting point that I just had not thought about, but I agree with it now that it has been explained to me. To my feeble mind.
Yeah.
I enjoyed, I'm sure you got a kick out of reading how little this movie changed from the book, that it just sort of seems like, I mean, I'll always remember the Coen brothers talking about adapting No Country for Old Men and basically saying one of us was lying on the couch, reading the book out loud, and the other person was on the computer typing it up. Just the idea that Cormac McCarthy basically writes screenplay books, or books that are borderline already screenplays, and that seems to be the way that Polanski looked at Levin's book Rosemary's Baby, in that it just sort of, he basically just didn't really change dialogue, and to the point where he called up Ira Levin at one point because there's a mention of a shirt in a New Yorker ad. Guy says, yeah, I got this shirt from the New Yorker ad, and he's like, what issue of the New Yorker was that in? He's like, Ira Levin actually made that up. And I mean, that's a moment that's in the movie, and it's these are things I did not know while watching the movie, but watching it a second time after I knew that stuff, it is kind of interesting that the way that time flows in this movie really does feel like it's in a novel, because there are so many short scenes, like really short scenes, and so much time passes, sometimes like well, when time passes in this movie, it tends to happen very quickly. And then we're like in a you know, span of 5 days for 20 to 30 minutes of the movie. And then we go past 3 months in the span of about a minute and a half. But there's just like really quick short scenes that you would think most people would totally just eliminate because you just wouldn't want to do all the setups required for a really short scene, especially in the 1960s. And I just found that interesting watching the movie for the second time, knowing how little was changed from the book, that I think that sort of naivete as far as Polanski not totally understanding how most people would adapt a novel. I think that naivety helps the movie, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think that also sort of like continues the feeling of not really being able to grab hold of anything in this movie. Just the way time passes seems to change radically from scene to scene.
Yeah, and it gives us those gradual shifts that make something that if it happened overnight, you would put your foot down and realize how crazy it is. But
yeah,
we see these characters go through these things, as you said, very slowly, just a few days at a time. And then that gives the idea that, you know, maybe it was this slow drift over 3 months. And that's how, you know, you can't judge Rosemary for some of the decisions that she makes, is because you can't put yourself in that spot where that gradual shift, it's not so noticeable, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just going back to the old versus new thing really quickly. I love the last shot of the movie because it's sort of mirrors the first shot of the movie. It might even just be the first shot of the movie again, of the exterior of the building. The opening credits are over this panning shot of the city of New York, and it ends up on the building that Guy and Rosemary end up moving into. And in this, the last shot, as Rosemary is finally starts rocking her baby in that crib sort of thing, and we get a dissolve into a different version of that same shot, and the camera stops on the building, and we see what is presumably a young couple walking into the building again. And I just sort of think that the way that this movie sort of uses shows the cyclical nature of these things, of the way that this cult is trying to destroy people, or is destroying people, because we've got Teresa at the beginning and then this new couple at the very, very end, and Rosemary all throughout the movie, of course. I just thought that was a nice small detail that really drives the movie home.
Yeah. Yeah, and in watching the beginning, that shot of them looking over the park and then ending up on Rosemary and Guy, mm-hmm. Once we have the bit of dialogue from the end of, you know, you should feel lucky, this is paraphrasing, but you should feel lucky out of all the women he chose you. That idea, and that what you said about an urban horror could be this idea that someone's always watching you and that there's so many people around, it's hard to keep track of. Like, I'm sure that Rosemary thought about her neighbors a lot in the 9 months that passed, but they're thinking about her so frequently, right? That they're getting their friends and they're, you know, they're doing all these awful things and thinking about her, and most more importantly, thinking about her child and not thinking about her at all, or at least not thinking about her well-being at all. On watching it the second time, is that you've been selected and that people have plans for you that are outside of your control. And that relates to so many of the bigger social and political topics that we've touched on in this, about Rosemary not having agency, not having control over her own body. Mm-hmm. Because you talked about that shot repeating, and you also mentioned the name of place, and I've been there. There's a couple instances of dialogue being repeated exactly in this movie. Did that stand out to you at all?
I was about to say, can you jog my memory? So I guess not. You know, I do not recall.
Yeah, there's him repeating that line, you know, within the same scene. There's the way
Sorry, what line?
The, you know, name a place and I've been there. Or
oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, that, yeah, okay.
A few times quickly. Yeah. And Rosemary talking about a guy's career and, you know, between Terry and Minnie. And I think there's one other person that she describes his career to. You know, she says he was in Luther and that other long title, and he's done some commercial or done some plays and some television work. The line is repeated verbatim. I just didn't know if you had any idea on that.
No, not really. I think it's just sort of something where, especially from the Rosemary line that you're talking about, that would be something that she would say to people who don't know both of them, where she's just in a conversation with somebody and you're just trying to make small talk. And since it's the 1960s, more small talk existed because people weren't looking at their cell phones all the time. Just the first thing to go to is you see a wedding ring. What does your husband do? You know, it's just something that is a natural jump off point for small talk. So it makes sense that it's something that just sort of naturally in life sort of becomes rehearsed. You know, if it's something that you get asked about a lot, eventually you sort of you settle on an answer that you give. So from Rosemary's perspective, it makes sense. And from Roman's perspective, he's just like, he's just an old weird dude. And that old weird dudes are just kind of old and weird. So I think that I don't have a reading beyond that. I think Rosemary's reaction to these things is pretty realistic, though.
Yeah, I don't have a kind of a deeper meta thinking on it either, but it's something that I like a lot, and something where I say that for all its supernatural scenes, which aren't that many, this does feel like a normal, realistic depiction of a relationship in the middle. And yeah, I think that you, in life, you kind of have those prepared statements, and in writing a novel or a screenplay, I can imagine that if you've noticed that you've written the exact same thing a few times, you want to mix it up just for the sake of not sounding too repetitive. But I think in life, you do have those things that this is the sentence I can give that has the least resistance to it and the least follow-up questions, and it gets what I'm trying to say across. And this movie is just, it's definitely not just a slasher movie that's padding out the time between the jump scares. And I think it, instead of padding out the running time, it fleshes out characters in the meantime. And that's something that's always going to make something last and feel good.
Yeah, exactly. And what you're saying about that repetition just sort of feeling realistic, I didn't even think about the most obvious example for me is like when you get asked, what do you do like as a career? That's something that happens to me once a week at least. I've been saying the same thing for 3 years, and I just say, oh, I do this, and then there's always the exact same follow-up question, and I have always the exact same follow-up answer, and it's just like real life is repetitive, you know. I think what you're it is a nice touch, and the natural inclination to somebody writing a screenplay would be, oh, we've got to take this out because we've already said that, because that's not what happens in movies, but that is what happens in life. So those aspects bleeding in sort of add an element of realism that then makes the movie more horrifying as time progresses. We haven't really talked about the direction of the movie, and the thing that I think really makes this movie work, and we've used the word nuance a handful of times, is that so much of this movie is told in long takes, but not flashy long takes. A lot of the times there's no camera movement, and when there is camera movement, it's pretty subtle. The phone call sequence, or the phone booth sequence, is the best example of this. It's also, in my research, I found out, kind of a famous scene. It's four minutes, 20 seconds or so, and an unbroken shot of phone booth, Rosemary trying to get in contact with Dr. Hill. And we mentioned the thing happens late in that shot where we just see the back of a man sort of come in from off screen waiting to use the phone booth. And it's just, it's like, holy shit, this guy's definitely going to kill Rosemary because this is a horror movie. And we're just so paranoid at this point of the movie because there's only like 20 minutes left. So we're very in Rosemary's head right now and her fear. And, you know, she doesn't realize he's there. He's just sort of standing there. He's not doing anything horrifying. But since we have gotten so sucked into this shot for probably 3+ minutes by that point, him just sort of appearing in frame is kind of terrifying. And the music starts rising at that moment. And when she turns around, she's like, how do I navigate this situation? Can I is this person here for me, or is this person here for the phone? Is this person going to be here for the phone as a cover for him being here for me? Like all of these things. And I think the reason that something like that can work as a scare is simply because you get drawn in by these long takes. And that's not to say that something like that happens in every long take in the movie, because the exact opposite is true. It might be the only time something like that happens in the movie. But that these takes can sort of like draw you in leads you to a point where you just sort of hypnotizes too strong of a word, but nothing breaks your concentration. Like no edit breaks your concentration, so that when something like that happens, it just really jars you out of what you've been expecting to see, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great sequence. And it's not just that it's a long take and she has to memorize all her lines, but it's a high emotional energy scene too, right? And
yeah, exactly.
That always adds to a long
take. Shot that on the first day of shooting for Mia Farrow as well. That's first thing she shot in this movie.
Wow. That's wild. And because of that high, the kind of high level of energy and emotion that is going into that, you're really kind of hooked and on her level as well. And then you, as you said, there's this looming presence and you want to pay attention to that, but you want to pay attention to her because, I mean, I think she does a fantastic performance throughout this movie. I think that she's really good in it. And I think that is one of the kind of showcase moments. And we should mention that, I mean, this is, I think she, or at least she was told that this is probably her chance at an Oscar. And I mean, it is kind of the checklist, right? I mean, the physical transformation, a little bit of Leo before Leo eating some eating some raw meat. And yeah, just big
scenes. And she's
like
a vegetarian
that.
Too, I think.
Yeah, no, exactly. And just how big she gets to go sometimes. It really is all there. And I think that she does a really good job on what is a pretty showy role.
Yeah, for sure. And I agree that definitely this has all the Oscar check marks that people like us that have been born in the 80s and cared about movies our whole lives have sort of expected. I don't really know what the predictable Oscar sort of performance would have been like in the 60s. Like, I agree that you're right, but I also suspect it might have been a bit different in the 60s. Like, Ruth Gordon's a perfect example. Her performance is the type of supporting performance that was just very much like something that was very showy and very performative and theatrical. That was something that was still noticed as like a really great performance, and she got nominated for an Oscar if she didn't win it, Ruth Gordon, for this movie. And the year previous was Bonnie and Clyde, and there is a supporting performance. I forget who the actress is that plays the role. I think she plays Gene Hackman's wife. She's in the movie for a very short period of time, and she won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, if memory serves. And I think she's terrible in that movie. And like the one glaringly bad thing about Bonnie and Clyde to that movie is her performance to me. And it's just because it's so like, this is what we give Oscars to in the 60s, you know? And I think that might be, maybe it's the only Oscar Bonnie and Clyde won. I don't know. I haven't double checked since we did a podcast on it years ago. But so I think like you are right in that it's a very Oscar-y performance. And Robert Evans did, to convince her and not quit the movie, tell her that this will be a movie that you will win an Oscar for. So yeah, but I just sort of think that there must be something slightly different, you know, like whatever the Nicole Kidman fake nose joke that we were telling in the 2000s to sort of, you're in the hours, you win an Oscar. I'm sure there was some version of that in the 60s, but I think it would have been slightly different, you know. But since we're talking about it, and I think this is a story you'll get a kick out of, Mia Farrow was married to Frank Sinatra at the time of production of this movie. Yeah. And was supposed to shoot a movie, I think it was called The Detectives, that Frank Sinatra was starring in, and she was supposed to be in it. And Rosemary's Baby went over schedule, over budget, and she was going to start shooting the two movies concurrently and then switch over full time to The Detectives. And then it went even further on off budget, and it sort of got to a point where Frank Sinatra, noted asshole Frank Sinatra, just said to her, it's either this movie or me. And she was served with divorce papers, and then she was thinking about leaving the movie, and Robert Evans, producer on this movie and who ran Paramount for a while, he showed her an hour of footage from the movie, like a very rough cut sort of thing, and he said to her, like, this is working, you will win an Oscar for this. And also, that's just a producer being like, oh, this movie's called Rosemary's Baby, and Rosemary's gonna quit the movie after we've already shot half of it. Like, this cannot happen, we're already over budget, this would be a catastrophe. So I mean, he's got that he's got to save his own ass too. But yeah, and she saw that, and it sort of helped make the decision easier to just choose Rosemary's Baby over Frank Sinatra, which I think was probably a healthy decision long term. Yeah, she got served with divorce papers on set by Frank Sinatra's lawyer. Which is so unbelievably old Hollywood.
Yeah, and as we were talking about this being the 60s and this movie that has wrapped up so much in gender, that is a great, I mean, it's an awful story, but it's a great meta story about an older man telling you what you should do with your life and career, and you taking the artistic way out and, you know, being served divorce papers as a result. And it's a terrible story in a way, but it's a illustration of struggles at the time.
Yeah, exactly. And even like listening to Mia Farrow talk about it, I was just watching an interview with her and just talking, like, that story gets brought up, and her response was just like, well, he's Sicilian, you know, it's just like, what is happening? But yeah, it's a crazy story, and it was the 1960s, and those things weren't necessarily seen as crazy at the time, especially like in Hollywood, you know.
Yeah,
because we just had so much less information about what was happening on film sets, so more ludicrousness was happening than we know about, for sure.
Certainly. Yeah. I think that we've mentioned a couple movies, and I think one that really bears mentioning is Mother, and the connection between those two movies.
I can see. It never crossed my mind until you brought it up, and it's pretty obvious now that you brought it up.
it's the number one movie to me.
Yeah, I see. I guess I didn't think about it. I just sort of knew pretty soon after watching this movie, I knew Stanley Kubrick loved this movie. And immediately I could see The Shining. I mean, we talked about the geography of the apartment. The false geography of The Shining is a real important part of that movie. And I also thought about Eyes Wide Shut a lot as well. Like, you can see a lot of both of those movies in Rosemary's Baby. But yeah, Mother is 100% Rosemary's Baby. I mean, if you've seen Mother, it only takes somebody mentioning that fact to you. You don't need me to explain it to you.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think any movie that I've ever seen is quite like Mother. But I don't think it's hard to connect the dots. I mean, basically, Minnie and Roman playing the two people definitely trying to over-interfere is, you know, those two characters times 10,000 is basically what happens in Mother. And I think one of the scariest sentences in the world is a mother asking, where is my baby? And that shows up and plays a big part in both of these movies. And as I said, Mother is, I mean, I'll watch Rosemary's Baby again. There's a good chance I'm never going to sit through Mother again. So they certainly have a different feel and a much different energy to them. I mean, this movie, you know, in the kind of the downbeats is more playful and more of a relationship character movie than a kind of ticking clock chaos movie that Mother is. But you know, there's a poster comparison between the two that goes to show just how many of the ideas cross over between those two films.
Yeah, for sure. Although I will say the most horrifying line of this movie is even more horrifying than Where's My Baby. It's the when Rosemary says, oh my god, this isn't a dream, this is really happening. That's the most horrifying moment of this movie. It is just really, I don't know. I can't even put it to words. It just feels horrifying.
I mean, that dream sequence is effective. And, you know, I think Mother was effective. And this movie kind of puts its foot on the brakes once in a while where Mother doesn't. I think that dream sequence has just kind of a mishmash of ideas and not just putting a filter over the passage of time the way, like a literal camera filter over something to just kind of blur it and make it feel like a dream. A dream sequence that feels more like a dream, and as far as things coming and going and starting on frame and ending up off of it and never really getting a grasp on it, but it being horrifying nonetheless, I think is a very interesting way to do that dream sequence in a very effective way.
Yeah. The dream sequence is very effective. I will say that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I have no idea how else to talk about it. I don't know. I don't have anything else to talk about with the movie.
That's good.
Yeah. We had an unsmooth transition from the intro, and we'll have a non-smooth transition to the conclusion as well. So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week.